And welcome, 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 dear listeners. Good morning, good morning, good morning. And that, the sounds that you specifically just heard there as they basically ended their particular sort of like song was Take That with the song Windows, or from the album This Life. Before that, it were the sounds specifically of Rodrigo Amarante with the song Tanto. And obviously, as we've started off with those particular mellow sounds on this morning session of my Sunday morning take, I do hope that wherever you are, that those particular sounds somehow, you know, warmed you up a little bit, as well as also laid the particular scene for our discussion for this morning. Well, not that I want the music to sort of like dictate the kind of mood that we do a discussion in, but it, you know, sort of like mellowed it out and ultimately gave you some pleasant particular sounds during the course of this morning's start on this Sunday morning session. Now, as always, dear listeners, you do know that you're in my company from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m. And specifically on the Sunday morning sessions, where we obviously take a look at everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and a little bit of everything else in between. We're once again on the discussion of history, but it has a little bit of economics in it specifically, because we're taking a look at what has been for the past, is it 3 months now? 3.5 months now, specifically. The particular theme that has dictated and has been on the lips of the whole world specifically. Here in Namibia, we've concentrated on other particular things. We've looked at other particular subject matter, but the rest of the world has obviously been fixated with particularly the developments, or actually the actions, that the US President Donald Trump has introduced into the rest of the world, because it is permeating through his economy into the rest of the world. If you have obviously lived in a rock or in a cave somewhere and you don't know what I'm talking about, and for those of you that do know or can get the hint that I'm talking about, yes, it is about this particularly long neglected subject matter that I haven't touched on in a long, well, I didn't touch on it since Donald Trump took the office on 20 January 2025. A little bit of a shame on me discussion, but it's obviously because the tariffs are being used as a mechanism to sort of like force negotiations from the rest of the world. I'm just going to give you that particular sort of like starting point to know of this. It's up to you to make, you know, to develop in your own mind in terms of whether or not this is a good discussion or is a good platform to start off bilateral relations. Many people obviously would not see, you know, how bilateral relations generate any particular benefit in most cases. Many Namibians, many average people, many everyday people, many lay people obviously would, you know, bilateral relations don't actually interact with you. In most cases, you only interact with the byproducts of international relations, or bilateral relations for that matter. What am I talking about? If you're perhaps an athlete, and let's for example say you get invited to, you know, your sport coach gets invited to a event or a particular competition, let's for example say in a country like Russia, then obviously that would be one of the results, because Namibia and Russia do have bilateral relations. Let's for example say you get invited, or you get a bursary to China. One of the particular sponsored bursaries obviously that had been negotiated between the Chinese embassy here and the relevant Namibian authorities here in that particular sector. And obviously you go there. That is one of the particular byproducts and results of bilateral relations. Or where you interact with most of the produced goods on in the retailers of your country. And in most cases, these products come from South Africa, And that is one of those particular byproducts of bilateral relations. Now, I make it always a point, dear listeners, to let you know that bilateral relations' aim, their overall or ultimate aim, is that two countries that have relations with each other actually reach a plane where they can trade with each other. Now, if you do remember back to the previous international relations minister that we had, that being former minister, Beya Mushilenga, who went to the inaugural international/foreign relations first ministerial meeting of BRICS countries that took place in Sochi last year. We had the particular discussion here also at Eagle FM taking place. If you remember back to that particular, if you remember back to the interview that he gave to Russia Today, which is one of the TV stations from Russia, the discussion obviously was based upon, you know, what does a gathering like that gathering at Sochi speak to a country like Namibia? And I'm just summarizing, but part of the things, part of the points that the former minister highlighted was specifically that this is based upon a discussion of mutual respect between the two countries, and obviously that relations starts from a mutual respect perspective. Now, you can obviously see that that is one of the starting points that is being focused on, and obviously what it translates to going ahead, and what does it look like in supposedly in the future in terms of where the international relations builds to. But I just want you to look at that particular scene, that particular aspects in terms of understanding, or how you translate specifically that specific roadmap or development. But you can obviously see it starts from a discussion where, two nations obviously have to recognize each other as being equal partners in the aspect of international relations. Now, giving you that sort of like vanilla introduction, the term vanilla usually in any particular discussion, specifically if it's on in online chat forums or discussions, the term vanilla always means standard, default, or it is, you know, just plain in that scenario. Many people actually forget that the flavor vanilla is actually not a default flavor. Just to let you know, in ice cream, it's not a default flavor. It's a flavor. So, our discussion for today, which focuses on tariffs and which is about the discussion of tariffs, obviously has been the buzz terminology the whole United States through. Because I mean, guys, there's not a day that my particular sort of like, because I always, you know, interact with YouTube for other particular intellectual insights, information insights, latest developments in the international realm. Obviously, other particular, which also includes continental and regional, because, you know, the AU also discovered YouTube in terms of broadcasting many of their particular developments. And, you know, that's where I observe most of these things that we obviously develop here for you on Eagle FM. Now, in our tariff discussion, dear listeners, we're looking at the starting point of them. Where did this notion of tariffs come from? There's actually a nice explainer that highlights where the origin of the word comes from. Or what is the origin of the word tariff? Yeah, because my explanation, if I completed the previous sentence, the previous part of that sentence, it would have sounded very weird. We're also looking at the origin of the word. Where does the word come from? Now, one of the nicest things specifically about, if you look at epistemology, because epistemology is about where do concepts and things come from? Where do they start from? What were their earliest influences and so forth? So the influences obviously would have meant what transmitted? Was there an action or was there a specific thing that transmitted this particular word from one culture, one language group into another culture and so forth? So starting on the aspect in terms of the tariff discussions, dear listeners, tariffs obviously are an import tax or a duty. Well, a tariff or an import tax, because they are pretty similar. So you obviously just have to, you know, you can use it interchangeably. This is a duty that is imposed by a national government or by a customs territory, for example, like SACU, which is a customs territory, or a supranational union on imports of goods, and it is paid by the importer. Donald Trump tries to change the explanation of this word so many times. I'll give you an example. Earlier this week, he was asked by, well, not this week, because according to me, a Sunday technically is the new week, you know, introduces us to the new work week. So let me rewind that a little bit. So back in last week, Donald Trump was asked in the Oval Office about who will absorb the tariffs. Because if you guys remember back at the start of this month, at the end of April, the largest retail companies, food retail companies, and their CEOs had an emergency meeting with Donald Trump at the White House. When they had that emergency meeting with Donald Trump, they told Donald Trump the tariffs that he introduced on the 2nd of April last month technically translates to them only having goods and food on their shelves probably by June. Now, after that meeting took place, you guys heard that there came out a 90-day tariff suspension window, which speaks about the 1st of July. Or is it the 31st of July? 1st of July or 31st of July? One of the two. Now, that obviously means that everything is now under this particular cloud of oncoming dread of a tariff, which will ultimately speak towards prices being increased on the shop floors of shops in the United States. Nowhere else. Nowhere else for us. Just in the United States. Just in the United States. Please remember that, guys. Nowhere else for us. Just in the United States. Because you've got to ask yourself the particular question of that which Namibia is selling to the United States, will it transmit a tax through to us? Not at all. Not at all. Let me say that again. Not at all. Because remember, you're already doing business based upon an agreed price. The agreed price is not a tax that is transmitted to you. When that cargo shows up there in any dock in the United States, it's applied there to the business that's importing the particular product. Now, when you sit with that particular understanding, and as I explained it to you now, this obviously means that when the particular product shows up, the product is obviously brought into that country that imported it, that bought the product, that imported it. And then they take it through the particular market, or they push it into the particular market that imported it. Now, as you're sitting with that particular understanding in terms of how a tariff works, because I tell you guys, I'm already sort of like, you know, the explanation of tariff is almost like a second language, second nature to me now, because that's all I hear. Now, this particular indicator highlights to you that it's the American consumer that will see this particular tax imposed on them. Once again, Donald Trump believes that a tariff is something that a country like Namibia has to pay. We don't have to pay that thing, guys. The only thing that will create a negative for Namibia is potentially the market becoming unaffordable. Meaning that whoever was importing whatever particular Namibian product will later on tell us it is becoming unaffordable. We're not making enough money to buy your product. So we're sorry. We can't import your product anymore. That just means that whoever was exporting whatever product from Namibia to the United States has to look for a new market to ship their product to. That's all. It's just about positioning the product somewhere else, gaining another market somewhere else. That's it. Straightforward. There is no tax transmission. There is no tax transmission. Exceptionally, an export tax may be levied on exports of goods of raw materials. and it is paid by the exporter. There is such a particular tax that can take place. That obviously would mean that an export tax may be levied on exports. Now, besides being a source of revenue, now remember, exceptionally, the word exceptionally is exception. Donald Trump is doing his particular tariff implementation on importing. Now, an export tax is actually a sanction in some cases. If you guys have never heard or understood how the sanctions work, specifically like against Russia currently, which is the most tariffed country, which is the most sanctioned country, sanctions are about literally targeting the exports of a country. So that means any country that does business with this country will be penalized. Which is pretty big. Now, besides being a source of revenue, import duties can also be a form of regulation of foreign trade and policy that burden foreign products to encourage or safeguard domestic industry. Namibia does that already. We do it already. So we are at fault of similar particular actions. Protective tariffs are also amongst the most widely used instruments of protectionism. That is what Namibia practices, along with import quotas and export quotas and other non-tariff barriers to trade. Now, the aspect of the protective tariff, so that you just, you know, so I can just jog your memory once again, is that a protective tariff are tariffs that are enacted with the aim of protecting a domestic industry. They aim to make imported goods cost more than equivalent goods produced domestically, thereby causing sales of domestically produced goods to rise, supporting local industry specifically. That is obviously if the local industry does grow. That is if they grow. Now, if you're a country that obviously has signed on to various other particular WTO statutes and the likes that is aimed at, you know, trying to facilitate global trade, and you're obviously trying to have an indication of that any particular trade barriers need to be removed or need to be taken away from, and the moment you show up there with protectionist measures and strategies, then yes, you are technically going against that particular, whatever particular legislation you signed from the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Yes. You would be, in some format, a belligerent. Now, since the particular tariff, discussion from Donald Trump has already begun, since 20 January, Just to let you guys know, there are disputes, trade disputes already being, that have already been lodged at the WTO by China against the United States. I'm just letting you know, this has taken place already. Now remember, Donald Trump hasn't taken the United States out of the United Nations. Because the United Nations, as a big pun, and this pun is intended, is literally the host country of the United Nations offices, buildings, and the likes. He has, however, signaled in one of his particular first executive orders to reduce funding to the United Nations because he believes that other countries are not supposedly doing their part. I still need to see a comprehensive particular discussion about that in terms of our countries, other countries paying their dues. And then, you know, basically, because the United Nations is the brain, they are the brainchild, or the United Nations is the brainchild of the United States. They are. So, funding responsibility, the United States obviously has to then bear a lot of that brunt. And it's literally the first thing that Donald Trump is taking away. Now, tariffs obviously are, or can be fixed, meaning they can become a constant sum per unit of an imported good or percentage of a price. We have something at the border known as an import tariff, an import tax. Importation tax. I think it's 16.5 still. And remember, when you bring in that product as a business and you sell that product in your stores, you still have to add the 15% VAT. Now, technically, when you go and think about the VAT tax aspect, value-added tax, value-added tax means that potentially this product was manufactured somewhere within the realm of the borders of your country. But if you imported a if you imported the product, why is VAT applied to the product? What you guys also need to understand, dear listeners, is that there's a lot of things that we in Namibia are being taxed for. Many products that should not have that tax on it. For example, if you just recently bought a new car, not a second-hand car, a new car. And I'm not talking about a second-hand Asian import. I'm talking about a car that is manufactured for the local market from South Africa. If you've bought a car recently, a new car, have you ever looked at the quotation? And you bought the car through your bank, I dare you, for anyone else, to go and look at that particular quotation that you get from the dealership. But it's a quotation that the dealership has to also send through to your commercial bank, which then obviously finalizes the particular, you know, transaction between them, you, and your commercial bank. If you look at that quote that is generated, you will see there's a levy. This levy is an environmental levy. It's known as a carbon tax, carbon emissions tax. This carbon emissions tax is something that is shipped across the border. It's transmitted to Namibian dealerships from South Africa. From South Africa, this carbon emissions tax. Now, it is a levy. It is an automatic 10%. The last time I saw that, which was 2017-ish. 2017-2016. It's a 10% tax. That's 10% onto the final price that you get. And to me, it translates to a discussion of being an unnecessary tax because of our own particular carbon footprint as a country, which is so small, so we're not a large polluter. We actually have environmental laws, but this thing is transmitted through from South Africa to us. Now that, dear listeners, is your export tariff or your export levy. That is an export tariff or an export levy. It's there. It's not supposed to be there because Namibia is, because I as a Namibian, I'm not a South African. However, as a Namibian, I'm exposed to a South African levy, which is transmitted through the local Namibian dealerships. Just let that sink in. That thing, obviously, that particular car that is not manufactured in Namibia or assembled in Namibia, then has the 16.5 import tax applied to it. And it has the 15% VAT applied to it. Not that the dealerships in Namibia are actually the manufacturers. They are just distribution outlets of the manufacturer's product that sits in South Africa. I'll let that sink in, guys. Because you can obviously see the conundrum of what it creates. Now remember, these guys, these distributors in Namibia, these car dealerships, they have to pay that 10% levy. They have to pay it. Because the manufacturer sitting in South Africa signed an agreement with South Africa because there's 60 million people living in South Africa and they've got a carbon footprint. There's 3 million Namibians here and our carbon footprint is negligible. Negligible, meaning you can ignore it. It's negligible. Now this obviously makes things tricky, right? Because you now need to go back and try and think about, do you really need to revisit your basic accounting on high school to understand how taxes and tariffs works? I'll factor this particular discussion in. Earlier this week, there's this other gentleman that I follow. He's an accounting professor at the University of Sheffield or Sheffield University in the United Kingdom. And as an accounting professor, he actually makes a lot more economic sense than a lot of economists actually make. Now, it's not that I'm saying economists are duds or that they don't have any brain cells. In many cases, economists are only exposed to historical data and actions. They also have to read the same policies that we as media or journalists have to read and know as well. Not that a lot of the journalistic colleagues out there actually read these things, because as journalistic colleagues, most of those guys like to talk to a person and they don't want to read a document. Just to let you know, they want to talk to a person and not read a document to get insights and in terms of understanding, why does this document exist? What does this document actually aim to achieve? It technically makes the whole exercise of reading, the way I'm explaining it, sound pointless, because you can obviously see that the realm of journalism is obviously about running after a person and not about analyzing the actual impacts of what you see in reality and what is supposed to happen from what a piece of document is espousing. So in that particular observation, you obviously have to ask yourself the question of, then, in terms of if you now go and revisit your basic accounting, should Namibians be exposed to certain particular transmitted tariffs or levies that are not applicable in a Namibian context? Because if you think about the words in said particular taxes or tariffs or levies, why are you paying for it? Now, here's the worst of the worst of the worst. There is no independent consumer protection agency that can champion certain particular things and certain particular causes in Namibia. There is no such agency. As a matter of fact, we don't even know what ultimately has happened to the Consumer Protection Directorate that was in the Ministry of Industrialization and Trade, because the Ministry of Industrialization and Trade was broken up. Trade was sent to International Relations, and Industrialization was sent to Ministry of Mines and Energy. It's a good ploy, because if you always look at the realm of things, mines and energy has a lot to do with industrialization. Trade has a lot to do with international relations. Let me let that sink in there. However, you should have a commerce agency or ministry. Commerce. Commerce. Interacting with the economy. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we're going to take a short musical break. And after the musical break, we're going to come back and head into the rest of this morning's engagement here, which is my Sunday morning take on your number one talk radio station of Eagle FM. We'll be back right after this.
Let's take our time. Just go nowhere, just stand still, don't care if we need.
Of your soul, that it's alright.
coming back there, dear listeners, from the sounds of the Arctic Monkeys. Yes, that's the band's name, the Arctic Monkeys, with the song Arabella from their album known as AM. Well, it was obviously the particular sort of like, at that stage, this album actually shot up their notoriety as a band because of the song specifically that you also would have heard. For those of you that were the FIFA game lovers, you would have heard the song specifically of Are You Mine? No, it's actually Do I Want to Know? And that obviously was a song that had a lot of traction when it actually came out. But then the album itself generated its own traction because the song, the whole album had the same particular theme. But enough of me about talking about, you know, albums of yesteryear specifically and their impacts in terms of pop culture. Just before the ad break that is about to dawn on us actually does show up, we will be coming back right after that ad break into taking a look and into the further discussions of tariffs and actually stepping into the second half of this morning's programming. We'll be back right after this.
You just got added to the GoTV Best Football Friends chat group. Let's go!
Final.
It's finals time and all the biggest players are in it to win it. Catch every Premier League, La Liga, Serie A, Champions League, FA Cup, Europa League, Conference League. To cut the long voice note short, you know who'll be there for you when you need to watch the finals. Stay connected to catch all the biggest football finals with your best football friend, GoTV. Love it.
Now coming back from the short ad break right there, and dear listeners, welcoming you to the second half of this morning's program of my Sunday Morning Take, specifically where you'll be up until you'll be in my company all the way up to 7 a.m. If you're just waking up, good morning. I do hope that you woke up at least to go and make a hot cup of something. I know we are close to the month of June. That obviously usually signals the start of our winter, but our winter seems to have started or began in the middle of May. Obviously, you know, giving us sort of like the heads up 2 weeks prior to the start of the actual thing. Now, on the particular discussion of tariffs and where we left off, which has been the subject matter, obviously, of this morning, tariffs have been used, obviously, as I indicated, to protect infant industries and emerging sides of a country's economy. Specifically from being either, firstly, a dominance being set up by larger international corporations or their products flooding your markets, the likes like that. There's many such indications in Namibia where we obviously have been flooded already. That's obviously also speaks towards if you do have someone manufacturing or creating or growing or actually producing the thing, then sometimes the governments are asked by the industries or the sectors that represent those particular products and goods whether or not they can get a little bit of extra assistance in the form of protection. Now, infant industry protection is something that does take place. However, there is almost a unanimous consensus among economists that tariffs are actually self-defeating, because they are. They are self-defeating and actually have a negative effect on economic growth and economic welfare. While free trade, which is that you don't have any tariffs placed on any products from specific destinations to your country, and the reduction of trade barriers like tariffs has a positive effect on economic growth. Now, American economist Milton Friedman, which is also one of the particular forethinkers, but one of the foremost particular global economists of the world of yesteryear, has indicated in one of his particular analyses of tariffs that we call a tariff, and this is his own particular words, we call a tariff a protective measure. It does protect. It protects the consumer against low prices. Although trade liberalization can sometimes result in unequally distributed losses and gains and can in the short run cause economic dislocation of workers in import competing sectors, the advantages of free trade are lowering costs of goods for both producers and consumers. The economic burden of tariffs falls on the importer, the exporter, and the consumer. Often intended to protect specific industries, tariffs can end up backfiring and harming the industries they were intended to protect through rising input costs and retaliatory tariffs. Import tariffs can also harm domestic exports by disrupting their supply chains and raising their import costs and their input costs. Just like that, guys. Just like that. Now, tariffs, or the word tariff itself, guys, actually comes from, the explainer that I've got here actually indicates that it actually comes from Arabic. The English term for tariff derives itself from the French term tarif, which literally translates to set price, which is itself a descendant of the Italian word or Italian phrase tarifa, which in its explainer is mandated price, schedule of taxes and customs, which derives itself from the medieval Latin term tarif, which is set, was also speaks about a set price. This term was introduced to Latin speaking world through contact with the Turks and derives itself from the Ottoman Turkish, where the word that they had back then was tarif. There's an apostrophe in the middle of the ta and the rif, which also translates to list of price, table of rates of customs. And the Turkish term itself is a loan word of the Persian word, romanized as taref, which is also translates to set price or receipt. The Persian term derives itself from Arabic. Romanized, the Romanized term is tarif. Notification, description, definition, announcement, assertion, inventory of fees to be paid, which is the verbal noun of the other Arabic word, arafa, which translates to know, to be able, to recognize, and to find out. Now, to understand in ancient history when the first particular tariffs were introduced, ancient Greece, in terms of records that were indicated, that were found, supposedly was the first to start with this. In the city of Athens, in the city-state of Athens, the port of Piraeus enforced a system of levies to raise taxes for the Athenian government back then. Grain was a key commodity that was imported through the port, and Piraeus was one of the main ports of the East Mediterranean. A levy of 2% was placed on goods arriving in the market through the dock of Piraeus. The Athenian government also placed restrictions on the lending of money and the transport of grain to only be allowed through the port of Piraeus. So it is a tariff with extra conditions for transport. And you can obviously see that this particular adding on of extra conditions obviously translated into an aspect in terms of how a key commodity should be handled, transported, potentially who are the designated allowed or authorized entities that can handle this particular commodity, product, and so forth. What I mean by this, for example, just look at the diamond industry in Namibia, the diamond mining industry. You and I as everyday Namibians, I am now assuming that you're also not someone that's involved in mining or specifically in diamond mining. That's now you, the listener out there. You and I as everyday Namibians or average people, lay people, who have no mining experience, no mining background, we would not be allowed into the Sperrgebied. We cannot be allowed into the Sperrgebied because we're not a designated authorized entity or party or persons. We're not. The conditions around the Sperrgebied is about that you need to be a designated authorized entity to have specific extra privileges, which are close to the same particular privileges that a Oryx has. No, I'm not making a joke, guys. Don't worry. It's not a joke. It's not intended to be a joke. It's literally an observation which equates to one that indicates that it seems like an Oryx and a specially designated authorized person have the same privileges in the Sperrgebied. Now, when you obviously sit and think about that particular indication, you realize that those are the set conditions applied to a specific part of Namibia. Now, the Athenian government, as mentioned, placed restrictions on the lending of money and transport of grain to only be allowed through the port of Piraeus. So you can obviously see the extra conditions being applied. We fast forward in human history to Britain in the 14th century, specifically where the English King Edward III took interventionist measures such as banning the import of woolen cloth in an attempt to develop local manufacturing. Now remember the 14th century, we're talking about the 1300s. Beginning in 1489, another English king, Henry the VII, took actions such as increasing export duties on raw wool. The Tudor monarchs, which was a specific dynasty of English kings, especially Henry the VIII and Elizabeth I, his daughter, use protectionism, subsidies, distribution of monopoly rights, government-sponsored industrial espionage, and other means of government intervention to protect the wool industry, their wool industry in the United Kingdom. But remember, this is obviously during a period where Britain was under threat from the Spanish, because the Spanish were pretty big after they discovered that South America existed with its abundance of raw materials. And no, I think they were still on their way. Yeah, they were still on their way to discover South America. This is the 13th century, yeah. No, 14th century, sorry. The aspect of this obviously translates to that there was a heightened fear of all-out war in a European context, because you also had the French at that scenario, the Dutch. There were obviously the Italian merchants in the Mediterranean that were obviously dominating things. They were obviously interacting with the Ottomans and other particular Middle Eastern and North African entities, states, and trading partners. The most important thing about this particular discussion also should highlight to you that you can obviously see that what was being placed in this particular discussion is that there was an aspect of protectionism taking place, which is highlighted obviously, in order to get the forefront or develop your particular industries locally. But this, as I said, was in a climate of, you know, fear of all-out wars between the various kinds of kings and monarchs in Europe. You then get a notion in terms of where a protectionist turning point in the British economic policy came in 1721, when policies to promote manufacturing industries were introduced by Robert Walpole. Now, Robert Walpole, dear listeners, was a specific nobleman in the United Kingdom. And he was actually a statesman. Now, they use a different term here, but it's not fast and, you know, big to fixate on. Who is generally regarded as the de facto first Prime Minister of Great Britain. And he served from 1721 to 1742. Pretty long. 20 years, actually. Now, his former titles obviously included also as the first Lord of the Chancery, of the Treasury. He was also a Chancellor in the British government back then. So you obviously can see that he was, you know, a pretty high up government official where he was pretty well entrenched in the matters of the government. Now, Walpole itself, or Walpole himself, in terms of that promotion of manufacturing industries, what he focused on, and these included obviously, for example, increased tariffs on imported foreign manufactured goods. He focused on export subsidies. He focused on reduced tariffs on imported raw materials, used for manufacturing goods, and the abolition of export duties on most manufactured goods. Now, this then led to the United Kingdom becoming, or being among the first countries back then to pursue a strategy of large-scale infant industry development. Specifically, Walpole outlined in his one of his particular policies, specifically, and I'm now quoting his particular terms, "Nothing contributes as much to the promotion of public welfare as the export of manufactured goods and the import of foreign raw materials." Now, Walpole's protectionist policies continued over another century. Britain remained a highly protectionist country until the mid-19th century. By 1820, the UK's average tariff rate on manufactured imports was 45 to 55%. That's a lot. Moreover, in its colonies, the UK imposed a total ban on advanced manufacturing activities that the country did not want to see being developed. Now, you can obviously understand why specifically countries like Namibia and the rest of Africa, we've got a huge problem. We are literally actually 300 years behind in most cases. These guys were already 300 years ahead of us. 300 years ahead of us. And that's even before the first Germans landed here in Namibia. You can obviously see the uphill that we've got to, that we've got to, you know, work against. Now, Walpole forced the Americans to specialize in low value added products. The UK also banned exports from its colonies that competed with its own products at home and abroad. The country then banned imports of cotton textiles from India, which at the time was superior to British products. It banned the export of woolen products from its colonies to other countries, which was known as the Wool Act. Finally, Britain also wanted to ensure that the colonists were the people, you know, the British settler communities that were in these colonies. They wanted to ensure that the colonists stuck to the production of raw materials and never became a competitor to British manufacturing. Do you guys see what's going on? Or what was going on? Policies were established to encourage the production of raw materials in the colonies. Walpole granted export subsidies on the American side and abolished import taxes on the British side on the raw materials produced in the American colonies. The colonies were thus forced to leave the most profitable industries in the hands of the United Kingdom. In 1800, Britain, with about 10% of Europe's population, supplied 29% of all pig iron produced in Europe, which is a proportion that had risen to 45% by 1830. So if you don't know what pig iron is, pig iron, also known as crude iron, is an intermediate good used by the iron industry in the production of steel. So it's a semi-processed product. It is developed by smelting iron ore in a blast furnace. Pig iron has a high carbon content, typically between 3.8 to 4%, 4.7%, along with silica and other dross. It makes it brittle as well, but minusing that particular dimension. Per capita industrial production was even higher, meaning per person in the United Kingdom or Britain back then. Per person, if you distributed the manufacturing output over the amount of people in the population, it was higher. the output generated by people. Remember, this is pre-labor laws, pre-child labor laws, pre-social welfare legislation and instruments being introduced. But even then, they were higher than any other part of Europe. Remember, there was a lot of wars going on as well. In 1830, it was 250% higher than the rest of Europe, up from 110% in 1800. Protectionist industrial policies remained in place until the mid-19th century. At the beginning of the century, and at the beginning of that century, the average tariff on British manufactured goods was about 50%, the highest of all major European countries. Now, despite its growing technological lead over the other nations, the UK continued its protectionist policy until the mid-19th century, maintaining very high tariffs on manufactured goods until the 1820s, two generations after the start of the Industrial Revolution, 50 years afterwards. Now, free trade in Britain began in earnest with the repeal of the Corn Laws of 1846, which was equivalent to free trade in grain. Now, the Corn Acts had been passed in 1815 to restrict wheat imports and to guarantee the incomes of British farmers. Their repeal devastated Britain's old rural economy, but began to mitigate the effects of the Great Famine in Ireland. Tariffs on manufactured goods were also abolished, but while free trade was progressing in Britain, protectionism continued on the European mainland and in the United States. Customs duties on many manufactured goods were also abolished. The Navigation Acts were abolished in 1849 when free traders won the public debate in the United Kingdom. But while free trade progressed in the UK, protectionism continued on the European continent. The UK unilaterally pursued free trade, even as most other industrial powers retained protectionist strategies and policies. For example, the USA emerged from the Civil War, its only Civil War, even more explicitly protectionist than before. Germany under Otto von Bismarck rejected free trade, and the rest of Europe followed suit. Now, after the 1870s, the British economy continued to grow, but inexorably lagged behind the protectionist strategies or policies of the United States and Germany. Because from 1870 to 1913, just before the First World War, industrial production grew at an average annual rate of 4.7% in the USA, 4.1% in Germany, and only 2.1% in Great Britain. Therefore, or thus, Britain was finally overtaken economically by the US around 1880. British leadership in fields such as steel and textiles was eroded, and the country fell behind as new, more technologically advanced industries emerged after 1870 in other countries still practicing protectionism. On 15 June 1903, the Secretary of State of Foreign Affairs, and that's the American, Henry Petty Fitzmaurice, made a speech this was a British politician. Henry Petty Fitzmaurice, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, made a speech in the House of Lords in the UK in which he defended fiscal retaliation against countries that applied high tariffs and whose governments subsidized products sold in Britain, known as premium products, later on called dumping. Now, if you don't know what that also translates to, this is specifically where there are governments in this world that subsidize companies. The companies get either a direct financial boost or specific policies in the economy that assist them in doing something or achieving a specific benefit. Now, obviously, Germany is a little bit different because VW is a state-owned company. Let me reiterate that again. That is direct involvement in the subsidy discussion. See, VW. You have other countries, obviously, other companies, specifically like the car manufacturing industry, that are directly in, that are directly subsidized by the state. Directly subsidized by the state. There are policies that protect them specifically to ensure them to grow. It exists the world over. However, it's a notion specifically of you need to incite, you need to instill a specific growth strategy at home in order to reach a specific competitive measure somewhere. Now remember, I'm talking about things that happened back in human history. Back in human history, it was only two parts of the three parts of the world that technically were technologically advanced in industrial endeavors. Hence the reason why I said a little bit earlier, we as Africa, we are literally 300 years behind. We are 300 years behind. Now before we continue, dear listeners, we're going to take a short musical break and we're going to come back right after this.
Summer girl, I didn't think I'd want you so. No, 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 summer girl.
And that there were the sounds of Jamiroquai with the song Summer Girl, ultimately bringing us up to the time of 6:30. If you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning to you. And you are in my company here on my Sunday Morning Take, which is particularly the platform that you enjoy every, you know, Sunday morning session from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Specifically, we will look at everything, history, everything, geography, a little bit of science and a little bit of everything else in between. Now, it is chilly. Don't worry. Don't worry. It is chilly. I know that. But obviously, I do hope that you've saddled up with something warm in terms of a warm drink. And ultimately, you know, just having a good listen to the particular subject matter that we've got here going on my Sunday Morning Take. Now, where I left off just before the break had been an indication, obviously, of back in 1903, one specific government minister of the United Kingdom back then highlighted, you know, that something must be done about countries that are obviously applying high tariffs to products that the British are selling to them, and who are, and these particular governments who subsidize the products that are sold to the UK. Now, the retaliation was to take the form of threats to impose duties in response to goods from that country. Which is what Donald Trump is doing. He first showed up threatening the world and telling the world, you will pay for this. And the whole world was like, we will see. Now, liberal unionists, that's still in the UK sense, had split from the liberals who advocated for free trade. And this particular speech marked a turning point in the particular group's slide towards protectionism. Now, Lansdowne, that's just now this particular gentleman's title, because it was a title he had, the fifth Marquess of Lansdowne, argued that the threat of retaliatory tariffs was similar to gaining respect in a room of gunmen by pointing a big gun. His exact words actually were, a gun a little bit bigger than everyone else's, end of quote. Now, the big revolver became a slogan of the time, often used in speeches and in cartoons. And in response to the Great Depression, Britain temporarily abandoned free trade in 1932, and the country actually reintroduced large-scale tariffs back then. In the US context, before the new constitution, was something that obviously kicked off in 1789, which was the Constitution of the United States. Before the new constitution took effect in 1789, the American Congress back then could not levy any taxes. It sold land or begged money from the states, meaning its other territories. The new national government needed revenue and decided to depend upon a tax on imports with the tariff of 1789. The policy of the United States before 1860 was low tariffs for revenue only, since duties continue to fund the national government. Now, the Embargo Act of 1807 was passed by the U.S. Congress in that year in response to European interference with American merchant shipping. While not a tariff per se, the act prohibited the import of all kinds of manufactured imports, resulting in a huge drop in U.S. trade and protests from all regions of the country that were dependent on these products. However, the embargo itself also had the effect of launching new emerging U.S. domestic industries across the board, particularly the textile industry, and marked the beginning of the manufacturing system in the U.S. Now, an attempt at imposing a high tariff occurred in 1828, but the South, that's now the South of the United States, denounced it as a tariff of abominations, and it almost caused a rebellion in South Carolina until it was actually lowered. This particular picture that I'm describing to you here is literally the picture that Donald Trump is using as a basis for motivation in 2025. A picture of 1789 and 1828, he is motivating in 2025. Let that sink in. Guys, let that sink into your thinking. Compare, if you want to compare yourself to people of or a time period of 1828, I would ask you to think very closely to what the conditions were. What were the conditions? Now, between 1816 and the end of the Second World War, the United States had one of the highest average tariff rates on manufactured imports in the world. According to Paul Bayrock, to himself is a particular scholar, the United States was the homeland and bastion of modern protectionism during this particular period. Many American intellectuals and politicians during the country's catching up period felt that the free trade theory advocated by the British classical economists was not suited to their country. They argued that the country should develop manufacturing industries and use government protection and subsidies for this purpose, as Britain had done before them. Many of the American economists of the time, until the last quarter of the 19th century, meaning the last 25 years of the 1800s, were strong advocates of industrial protection. Daniel Raymond, who influenced Friedrich List, Matthew Carey, and his son Henry, was one of Lincoln's economic advisors back then. The intellectual leader of this movement was Alexander Hamilton. If you don't know who Alexander Hamilton is, he's, I think, one of the founding fathers of the United States, meaning one of the founding members of the Constitution of the United States. Alexander Hamilton himself, he also served as the first U.S. Secretary of the Treasury from 1789 to 1795 during the presidency of George Washington, meaning the first U.S. president. Which obviously shows you that Hamilton himself had a particular sort of like stake in the affairs of running the economy back then, the infant economy that America actually was now starting to develop. Now, the United States rejected David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage. Now, David Ricardo was a British political economist, politician, and member of parliament, and he was recognized as one of the most influential classical economists alongside figures such as Thomas Malthus, Adam Smith that wrote the famous book that all economists actually start off, the Economics Bible, known as the Wealth of Nations. That's the book that they all start off from. And James Mill. Now, David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage, which is a discussion in an economic model. A comparative advantage is an economic model which is the advantage over others in producing a particular good. For example, Namibia's particular comparative advantage is our tourism industry. It's not our fishing. It's not our diamond mining. It's not anything else. It's our uranium mining. It's our tourism industry. It's our red meat industry. It's, what else is there? And services. What many of us forget is how good Namibia is in the services industry. That's Namibia's comparative advantage. Now, this obviously meant that, you know, since they rejected Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage, they outrightly protected their industries henceforth. Now, the United States pursued a protectionist policy from the beginning of the 19th century until the middle of the 20th century after the Second World War. In a report on manufacturers, which was a specific report that was generated by the Americans regarding their particular, you know, their particular economic activity, it considered the first text, you know, to express modern protectionist theory. Now, Alexander Hamilton argued that if a country wished to develop a new activity on its soil, it would have to temporarily protect it. According to him, this protection against foreign producers could take the form of import duties or, in rare cases, prohibition of imports. Hamilton called for customs barriers to allow American industrial development and to help protect infant industries, including bounties, i.e. subsidies, derived in part from these tariffs. So if you're bringing in a car from another country and you have a car manufacturing plant, you impose a tariff on that car that is imported, and the money that comes from that tariff that is generated is then used to help the car industry that is in your country. That's awesome. But anyway, that's the particular scenario. Now, Hamilton also believed that duties on raw materials should be generally low. Hamilton argued that despite an initial increase of price caused by regulations that control foreign competition, once a domestic manufacturer has attained it to perfection, it invariably becomes cheaper, which is obviously that economies of scale discussion that they're talking about. Now, in this particular report back then, look at these guys, they were generating reports back then. In most cases, for example, here in Namibia, at the start of Namibia's independence, there's very few reports to leverage from, except if it's IMF and World Bank reports. Hamilton also proposed export bans on major raw materials, tariff reductions on industrial inputs, pricing and patenting of inventions, regulation of product standards, and development of financial and transportation infrastructure. The U.S. Congress adopted the tariffs but refused to grant subsidies to manufacturers, which is technically manufactured goods or the industries. Hamilton and Daniel Raymond were among the first theorists to present the infant industry argument. Hamilton was the first to use the term infant industries and to introduce it to the forefront of economic thinking. Hamilton believed that political independence was predicated upon economic independence, and increasing the domestic supply of manufactured goods, particularly war materials, was seen as an issue of national security. And he feared that Britain's policy towards the colonies would condemn the United States to be only producers of agricultural products and raw materials, literally where Namibia is. Now, Britain initially did not want to industrialize the American colonies, as I explained a little bit earlier, and implemented policies to that effect, for example, banning high-value added manufacturing activities. Under British rule, America was denied the use of tariffs to protect its industries. This explains why, after independence, the Tariff Act of 1789 was the second bill of the Republic, signed by George Washington, along with Congress, to impose a fixed tariff of 5% on all imports, with few exceptions. Now, the Congress, the U.S. Congress for that matter, passed the Tariff Act of 1789, imposing a 5% flat rate tariff on all imports. And between 1792 and the war with Britain of 1812, that war took technically place in Canada, on the border with Canada. The average tariff level remained around 12.5%, which was too low to encourage consumers to buy domestic products and thus support emerging American industries. When the War of 1812 broke out, all rates doubled to an average of 25% to account for increased government spending. The war paved the way for new industries by disrupting manufacturing imports from the UK and the rest of Europe. A major policy shift occurred in 1816, when American manufacturers who had benefited from the tariffs lobbied in to retain them. Now legislation was introduced to keep tariffs at the same levels, especially protected were cotton, woolen, and iron goods. Before we continue, we're going to take a short ad break.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Coming back from that quick ad break, which gives an indicator in terms of being in the last 15 minutes and just specifically where we left off, everything that I've highlighted to you, dear listeners, is technically what is taking place right now, today. Now, obviously, as you can see, one of the particular sort of like, if I can call it mischievous activities that Donald Trump is trying to generate or trying to cause is actually bring manufacturing from other countries to the United States, or forcing other countries to tell their companies if they want to sell to the United States and have a cheaper good entering the United States borders, that they technically open up a plant or a factory in their country. Which is, in best part, it is actually known as a little bit being of a, it's coercion. It's straightforward coercion. Now, I just want to supplement this because there's actually something that I was reading in terms of, you know, just for interest's sake back at home. Obviously in terms of planning for this program for this morning as well, is that the European Union has come up with a piece of legislation known as the Something Coercion Act. Industry or Economic Coercion Act or something like that. But the word coercion exists. The word, that particular legislation, dear listeners, if any government coerces, now if you don't know what the word coerces means, the word coercion, or to coerce someone, is almost like blackmail. Persuade an unwilling person to do something by force, by using force or threats. That is what the word coerce means. Now, in legal terms, you get the word duress. Now, duress typically is like an unidentical twin brother of coerce. Duress is when someone does something under threat of harm or under threat of force being applied to them. So they were under duress. Coercion is obviously the use of the use of the threat of force or harm being applied. Now, the European Union has come up with a particular legislation, that if someone else's government coerces or uses coercion to achieve an economic benefit or an economic advantage over the European Union, the European Union has this piece of legislation, this piece of law, that they can apply to any government in the world. It's a law now. It's a law. Which is beautiful, just like the GDPR, which is also beautiful. Many particular commentators out there are highlighting that if Donald Trump is gonna continue with whatever he's gonna continue with, the EU will probably have as a last result, as a last resort, this particular piece of legislation that they can use against American companies operating in the EU. Now remember, in the broader discussion of international relations, when the United Kingdom was part of the EU, they weren't a full member, but they were like an extra member. It's them and Denmark. It's them and Denmark. They have these specific sort of like, they're not full members, but they have certain privileges in terms of being a participant of the single market concept of the EU. The full members are obviously the other 27 states, minus what I just highlighted to you, Denmark and formerly the United Kingdom. Now, there was once a particular accusation that one European scholar made in terms of saying that the United Kingdom is a avenue for the American economy to have to gain access to the European Union, specifically through the financial services that the UK provides, from the City of London or from London. And this becomes a particular discussion in terms of understanding, okay, so this means that the British realize that they are a conduit for American financing into the European Union. And that if the European Union wants to do vice versa, companies doing vice versa, there was some specific privilege, special privilege that the UK had wherein London featured as the financial hub of the European market. Now, obviously, when Brexit happened, that was taken away from London. And it was placed in Frankfurt. And it was placed in Paris. And it was distributed somewhere else into Rome. And it was placed in Madrid. And it was placed in Brussels. And it was placed in, where's the other financial hub of Europe? Is it Rotterdam or Amsterdam? And it was placed in Amsterdam. You guys get the drift that I'm obviously indicating here to you. Is that this was, that particular privilege was taken away from one country when it decided to exit from the European Union's single market concept. And now they lost that specific privilege or that specific position as being the go-to financial hub for Europe with the rest of the world. Now, this particular discussion, obviously, dear listeners, I should highlight to you that things were finicky. Now, when I did the Great Depression discussion back in March, just so that you know, there was an act from the Americans that featured there. It was the Smoot-Hawley Act. Now, it was a tariff act as well. Now, this tariff act actually created or exacerbated the impacts of the Great Depression in the American context, and it actually reverberated from the American economy into the rest of the economy back, into the rest of the global economy back then. Just so that you know, dear listeners, the Great Depression was greatly experienced, as I mentioned a little bit earlier in our talk, only in three parts in the world. North America, Europe and the Middle East, and Eastern Asia. Far East Asia. Eastern and Far East Asia. When you look at these particular impacts itself in terms of the negatives and the perceived positives that obviously are supposed to be generated from tariffs, is that the use of tariffs is supposed to be a discussion of trying to generate some sort of domestic output, because the impact analysis that had been observed across history has been a notion of domestic output, productivity, and welfare generation. So this means An empirical study that was done by Furcheri in 2019 found that protectionist policies like raising tariffs significantly actually reduces domestic output and productivity. Let me say that again. Actually reduces domestic output and productivity. At a study, another study that from 1999 by a Frankel and Romer, two other particular academics, indicated that after accounting for other factors, they took into consideration other factors that also existed back then. Countries with more trade tend to have higher growth and income. The effect is quantitatively large and statistically significant versus a country that introduces tariffs. Now, the tariffs, or that overall tariffs actually reduce welfare, is not controversial among economists, because in a 2018 survey by the University of Chicago, about 40 top economists were asked whether new US tariffs under Donald Trump 1.0 on steel and aluminium would benefit Americans. Two-thirds strongly disagree, and the rest simply disagreed. None actually agreed. No one agreed. Now, several explained that these tariffs would help a small number of Americans, but they would harm many more Americans. This was consistent with the basic economic analysis that was provided, as we explained a little bit earlier, which also indicated that costs to consumers are larger than the combined gains for domestic producers. Because if it is more expensive for the consumer will just stay away and save their money, thus leading to a severe loss and reduction in income for whoever is selling and importing that product. Here's another particular thing which also highlights the very dangerous thought process that some world leaders sometimes have. For example, and I allude back to the COVID pandemic itself, Donald Trump highlighted that, because with the introduction of the tariffs, Donald Trump highlighted earlier this month or late last month, that, the retailers made profits last year, so why are they complaining? But what people don't understand is those guys want to continue making positive gains instead of just stopping at 1 year, and then they don't make any positive gains in the business that they're doing. Because what is the aim of a private company? To make profits. If it makes profits, it invests in hiring people. If it makes profits, it invests in distribution, in opening up further distribution points for the business or that it is in. If it makes profits, it starts paying taxes, or it pays its taxes. I shouldn't say start, because they should be paying at the start, from the start. If they make their profits, they invest or spur on other business entities to supply to them. If it makes profits, people can have more income potentially, depending on the contracts that were signed with them. If it makes profits, there's obviously further particular economic base and economic activity that would be encouraged further on, besides the other economic encouragement that I highlighted a little bit earlier. If it makes profits, it leads to, what you call it, a increase in the tax base of the amount of people that they will hire further on, and so forth, and so forth. We can go on. But that's under the nuance that the host country, or the country that this company is operating in, does not have an aggressive protectionist strategy or policy, does not engage or pursue retaliatory tariffs or predatory tariff regimes in its economic policies, if it pursues free trade and accessible trade into the global markets and global economy, sure. Many Namibians tried to understand or were confused when, what's his name, the South African Agriculture Minister, John Steenhuisen, under the GNU, the South African Government of National Unity, was literally questioning the protectionist measures that Namibia's agriculture ministry was employing. It is their right to do so, guys. It is their right to do so. The second thing that we need to ask about that question was a discussion of, did Namibia inform South Africa of these actions? Because it was South African farmers that were telling the South African agriculture minister, Namibia is doing this. Now, I will tell you again. I am yet to be proven wrong by production metrics that come through from the Namibia Agronomic Board, whether or not Namibian producers can actively, sustainably supply fresh produce throughout the whole year. Do you know that Namibian tomatoes, dear listeners, back in last month, 1 kilogram bag of Namibian grown tomatoes was retailing at a price of 50 Namibian dollars, 50. But a South African sending a bag of tomatoes at 1 kilogram is coming to me as a Namibian at 30, sometimes below 40, close to the $40 mark per kilogram price mark. There is nothing wrong with Namibians trying to improve on things. I'm actually for, and I actually understand the protectionist strategy discussion. But for Steenhuisen to come in and to be aware of this particular discussion, and for Schletwein before he retired to actually transmit the message by saying, no, it was a subtle agreement between the Namibian Agricultural Ministry and the South African Agricultural Ministry, with the predecessors of the South African Agricultural Ministry. It's either one of two things. Either someone does not know about this particular thing, or someone was not told about this thing beforehand. I obviously think that you and I, we know who we're talking about, i.e. Steenhuisen. However, dear listeners, protectionism only works for so long. It only works for so long. Now, that ultimately brings us up to the end of this morning's particular discussion. We're quickly stepping into a short ad break. After the ad break, we'll be stepping into a musical break afterwards.
Need lightning fast internet? Paratus has you covered. The network Namibia relies on. Whether for business or pleasure, Paratus' cutting edge technology ensures both reliable and speedy internet connectivity. We exist to serve your needs through our high quality network and pride ourselves in offering client service excellence. Connect to Paratus today. Visit us online at paratus.africa/Namibia or call us on 083-300-1000. Always
Paratus. Now, as we come back, dear listeners, obviously the particular discussion has been about, whether or not tariffs actually try to achieve their intended purposes. We've obviously seen in historical cases where you've had bad actors literally particular policies generated by politicians of yesteryear who had intended purposes of of actually trying to keep certain particular economic developmental developments subdued in other parts of the world. Actually had predatory and retaliatory mindsets in terms of protection, and then trying to transmit the protection to other territories in the world. And then obviously this has led to the particular deficiencies, like I explained a little earlier, that Africa is actually 300 years behind in industrialization. Now, on that particular note, dear listeners, we get into the musical break.